Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our extra credit episode for August. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and we are at strangestudies.com. And of course, on Patreon, where you're listening to this, you are one of the special people, one of the elite. And so you get this, our discussion on Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, or more specifically, the Disney film from 1951, Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. Well, who knows what we're going to cover, because I literally didn't take any notes for this today. I've been going through a pretty crazy journey this month, because when we read the first story of the month, Mimsy Were the Borogoves, they were talking about how one of those time machines went back to this guy, Charles Dodgson. And I thought, oh, Lewis Carroll has a secret identity. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
And also, Alice is based on a real person. Didn't know that either.
Oh.
That's how non-steeped I was in this stuff. Never read the book.
I knew those things.
And now I've come all the way out on the other side where I know probably more than I wanted to know about Lewis Carroll.
Yeah.
With a little sprinkling of uh-oh sauce on it. And I've watched the film. In fact, I've watched a few of the films. And I'm about halfway through the first book. And I'm really enjoying the book. I think that that is an amazing thing. I'm sorry to come on here to talk about a book I haven't fully read, but I think that Alice is more of a cultural experience.
Yeah.
It's something that seems to be just in the zeitgeist. And so that's why I wanted to just kind of discuss it openly with you.
Sure, yeah.
So where should we start?
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was written by Lewis Carroll, AKA Charles Ludwig Dodgson, who was born in 1832 and he died in 1898. The book was originally published in 65, and it was well received at the time and has become a huge influence on Western culture. I've seen people say that this book was the Harry Potter of its time. It had a sequel, Through the Looking Glass, which came out in 1871 as well.
I would say that, I mean, the Harry Potter of its time has really given a lot of credit to Harry Potter. It's way better than that.
Oh yeah, no. Just in the popularity. Is what I meant.
For sure.
Not the quality of book.
Well, you know, Lewis Carroll actually was a teacher at Christ Church College in Oxford for most of his life. And the dining hall in that facility is what they use for the dining hall in the films of those Harry Potter movies. So I guess there's some connection there. It's hard to, you know, typically I'm not somebody who likes to know a lot about the author or the creator of the art. I just like to consume the art. And so in terms of he having an actual relationship with the girl Alice, and it's in the book, like right away it opens with a poem about this golden summer day.
Yeah.
All in the golden afternoon, full leisurely we glide, for both our oars with little skill by little arms are plied, while little hands make vain pretense our wanderings to guide. So he's letting you know right off the bat, this is based on something that happened. He's rowing down the Thames with another fella and these three sisters, the Littles, and they're begging him to tell a story. And he's saying, oh, next time, next time. And they're saying, no, it already is next time. Tell us this story. And so he begins unspooling this rather nonsense Alice in Wonderland, or I think in the first publication of the book that he did, it was called Alice's Adventures Underground, completely making it up on the spot. So what we're reading is the product of an actual interaction. As such, it's a little more interesting to study his life and what was going on.
I'm interested in the adaptations of it because there are quite a few. I thought there was only 13, but you said there's more that wasn't on IMDb. But its actual first adaptation was done in 1886 as a musical in London. And Carroll was actually involved with that, and he selected the actress that played Alice. It's been revived many times around Christmas. It's one of these plays that's kind of like the Nutcracker, where Christmas time, you know, it would get played a lot. I don't know if it's so much anymore, but definitely when it came out, it just kept coming back for the next 50 years or so.
Well, it really became his business doing these Alice things. Although, I mean it that it really was a secret identity. He had his job at Christ Church, and if mail came to him for Lewis Carroll, returned to sender. He didn't want anything to do with it. This was somebody who did not particularly embrace being a huge famous author.
All right.
But he did, well after he had a relationship with the Little family, continue to do the Alice books. He did that sequel. As you say, he was involved in this. And I think he grew up, you know, his father was, I believe, a reverend or, you know, in the church. He had a big family, mostly girls. And I think that Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is directed towards these children, but it's also a lot about his own youth and probably different things that he was preoccupied with as well. There's a really, I think Virginia Woolf said, the amazing thing about Lewis Carroll is that he never lost access to what it is like to think like a child. And I think that is why, as I read it, it has such a powerful voice, because we all sort of forget what it was like. And we talk about this a lot on the show. It's definitely in line with Mimsy Where the Borough Goes, but also back when we were talking about Child's Play in a more horrific aspect of it.
Sure.
But that anything's likely when you're a child because you don't know the rules yet. So animal starts talking. Yeah, that sure. I figured if they were going to talk, they'd talk to me. Toys come to life. Well, I figured if this was going to happen, I'd be the one to witness it. You're a protagonist in your life. You don't really have a lot of experience of the whole world.
Sure.
And when you read Alice in Wonderland, that's really alive. Alice doesn't particularly get too upset about the things that are happening to her.
Yeah.
She falls down that hole after chasing the white rabbit for a very, very long time and is thinking, well, this is kind of strange. And that's about it.
Yeah.
As she encounters these people, she's trying to figure it out. As a protagonist, she's really funny. There's a lot of humor in the book. I would say to folks, I know we're going to talk about the film adaptations, but the book itself, you really get a sense of her character as a protagonist. And I think for that era of literature, it was a pretty shocking type of story to tell. In one respect, it's because it's a graphic novel. You know, it's got images placed in with the text, which was not something that they would have had at that time. A book, traditionally, if it did have artistic plates, it would have been on a separate page. These are in there.
Right.
It's a vital part of the story. And I think why it lends itself to adaptation so much is because those images, you have storyboards already.
Yeah.
And I saw on YouTube, they actually, the British Film Institute, there's a 1908 filmed version of Alice in Wonderland. It's about 10 minutes long.
That's right. Yeah, you were talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's worth watching. It's on there and they've restored it and as much as they can because it's pretty damaged. I think it's appealing because right away it kicks off with some special effects. Her falling down the hole, but then drinking and eating the things to get larger and smaller. The minute you have a camera, you think, ooh, I can do some perspective things. I can do some compositing and these types of things right away. That would be the first special effect that people would be attracted to.
Mm.
Also, the non-human characters you can have in costumes and masks and that sort of thing. So 1908, and I do think that there's an Edison 1910 film as well.
Wow.
Before the 1915 one that you watched.
Yeah.
You watched that one, right?
Most of it. I didn't sit through the whole thing. But it came out in 1915. It was silent. Mm-hmm. Pretty strange. You know, it was all right. It just felt like a silent movie. But the 1931 version that I saw bits of, that was creepy. There was something just off about it. It was low budget, so all the sets were really small.
Oh.
So it felt like somebody was forcing people to make it in somebody's cellar.
Well, now, is that the same as the 33 one?
I don't think so. Those are two different ones.
Because there's a 1933 one that's chock full of movie stars.
Yeah, this is a different one.
Oh, so it creeped you out, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're all a little creepy.
But this one was especially creepy. It felt like the cast was kidnapped and made to perform this stuff in somebody's cellar.
Oh my goodness. Maybe that's the correct adaptation of it. That's the only one that got it right. Well, the Edison one is interesting because most of the cast are kids, even the Mad Hatter. And, you know, so it's kind of got more of a sense of fun, I think.
Right.
Because they're children playing around. But the 33 one was sort of, I don't know if it did very well, but for the era, it's just got a ton of movie stars in it playing those different roles.
Yeah.
Definitely overshadowed by The Wizard of Oz.
Sure.
You know, a few years later.
I sat down and watched the 1951 Disney animated movie for this extra credit, and I tried to watch also the Tim Burton movie from 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't have a lot of nice things to say about it.
Yeah.
You know, it looks neat, as Tim Burton movies do, but...
Yeah. I got about 20 minutes into it. Had to shut it off. So, yeah, same here. I just thought, this is soulless.
Yeah. It's soulless, yeah. And in that version, it's kind of a sequel because Alice is like 20-ish and she's supposed to marry some lord who she doesn't like. She runs off when he proposes to her. She chases the rabbit.
Yeah.
You know, like she sees the rabbit after to get out of having to answer his marriage proposal.
Right.
And she has no memory of being in Wonderland before, but all of the characters she meets remember her.
What an odd way to do it.
Yeah. I don't understand that. There's so many things about it I didn't understand. But there's a White Queen, which is Anne Hathaway.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the White Queen, which I don't remember there being a White Queen in the book.
No.
And then, of course, they've got Helen Bonham Carter is Queen of Hearts, and she's got like a giant head. They did some weird computer stuff to give her a giant head.
Sure.
Which I saw in that earlier one, the one that was from 99 with Martin Short, they did that with him, and it was way better than that one.
Martin Short is perfect for that
part. It's the Mad Hatter. He's great as the Mad Hatter.
Yeah.
If you go on YouTube and watch some of the stuff, it's one of those things where the effect works way better in this thing that was in 99, so like 10 years earlier. It's more interesting.
Now, I've heard that the best adaptation in terms of being true to the book is the one from the 80s that was for television. Also on YouTube, you can watch the whole thing. And that also is full of big stars from the time.
Yeah,
they do it credits at the beginning, and it's just, man, as a little kid, I would have been like, my parents would have been thrilled because they were fading stars who were now doing television. So yeah. I might not have known who they were as kids, but there's a whole cult of people who that's the true Alice adaptation is that one from the 80s.
I haven't seen it. But in the Tim Burton movie, Alice gets some armor and she fights the Jabberwocky with the Vorpal Sword. And for all you nerds out there in AD&D first and second edition, a Vorpal Sword would chop a person's head off if you rolled a 20 after bonuses applied, not a natural 20. So if you've got a decent fighter, you've got a pretty good bonus to hit. So you can be lobbing people's heads off with like 20% of your attacks. It was a much sought after weapon. The Vorpal Sword was a big deal.
Yeah, snickety snack. Well, that just tells you how predominant this stuff is, that it made its way into Dungeons and Dragons. The funny thing is about that whole setup in the Tim Burton film is it's so unnecessary. In the book, in all of these adaptations, she's hanging out by the side of the river, bored, sees the white rabbit, let's get going.
Yeah.
You really don't need the shorthand of, her having to listen to her sister read and just being a bored kid is enough of a setup. When I was watching the Tim Burton one, I go, well, they're going to have to pay all of this stuff off somehow. So they're imposing order on nonsense.
Yes.
The whole point is that it's somewhat nonsensical.
Yeah, there is an actual story in there, which is kind of stupid.
Yeah. Oh, well, I love Ed Wood.
Ed Wood's great.
He's just doing a job for Disney. Who knows?
Yeah. It's just not my thing. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now, this 1951 movie, you said you didn't like it.
So I just watched it for the first time yesterday. And you know what? I think it was a flop when it came out.
Yeah,
I don't think folks liked it that much. It had some resurgence later because it was playing on TV, or I think they might have even brought it back into the cinemas in the 70s. It's beautiful, and I know that there's some animation techniques going on in there that are pretty interesting. I mean, I was sort of fascinated just by the run cycles and stuff. When she's moving around, she looks like, I don't know if they rotoscope part of it or,
yeah. Yeah, they rotoscope.
Well, it looks amazing. The colors are so vibrant. If you have that on in the background while you're listening to some good music, I think it's a great movie. But I hated the music in it. Just hated it. It was making me angry.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why. I guess it's just so bland and major key. And I've been listening to some close vocal harmony music from the era that was a trendy thing to have, where they have lots of interesting jazz chords in there and some really amazing singing. Whereas in this, it's all choral, goody two-shoes kind of. I couldn't now tell you what any of the songs sound like because they just come and go. And it was like,
well, happy on birthday song. I think it's great. A very merry on birthday to you, to me. A very merry on birthday to me, to you. You don't remember that?
You're making me so mad right now. It's the end of the podcast.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No, I guess, you know what? That was that scene among the whole movie was a pretty good scene.
That's
and pretty fun. I agree. No, that was a fun song.
It sounds neat. It's different than all the other songs.
Yeah.
And it captures that kind of nonsensical weirdness of it. And it's fun. It's a fun song.
I'll give you that.
I like it because it was on a Disney compilation album for kids. And my kids listened to it when they were little. And so that was one that I always enjoyed.
It was definitely a hallucinatory experience, that scene in particular. It never ended. They're putting butter on that clock and it just goes on and on and on. And I think that to a child, a lot of adult behavior is like this, which is why why it keys into this idea that adults are mad about stuff you can't understand. They're arguing about concepts you don't get. And so it sounds a lot like a bunch of the nonsense because these are not nice people in this world underground.
No.
That Alice encounters. Now, Lewis Carroll was a bit of an OCD kind of dude. He was an interesting guy. He was a teacher, but he didn't. As a teacher at Christ Church, I believe he had to take a vow of celibacy, actually.
Weird.
But he never went on to become ordained. So that would have required him to have a parish and to do mass and that kind of thing.
Oh, right.
Which he wouldn't have been able to do because I don't think it was a particularly awful speech impediment, but it was enough that he had trouble speaking in front of groups of people. And I believe that it is well known that he had very meticulous habits, was incredibly neat. And what's so interesting is he went and he wrote this book for Alice and gave it to her as a Christmas present. So there's a copy of Alice's Adventures Underground that is the very first edition, hand-lettered by Lewis Carroll, not a mistake in the book. It's, you know, he meticulously copied each page. Early on in the book, there's The Mouse's Tale, which is a poem that's presented on the page in the form of a long mouse's tail. It's really cool to see the original thing. He did it on the page. Later, when they printed the book, they had to typeset that, you know, so you can go look at the original plates and see that they had to, this was an innovative thing to play with the actual text on the page and make that poem have the shape of the mouse's tail. It's a really great poem, and it's a really cool, innovative thing that he was doing. Actually, I think the reason I'm saying this is because I don't think that tea party scene was actually in the first cut. That was a later addition. Because after having gifted that to Alice, obviously big hit in the family, okay, you know what? Everybody should be able to read this. So he had some connections with the publisher, wound up getting this book published, and it was a big hit, but added some things to it later, although it's very similar. Now, he himself did the illustrations.
In the first book.
In the first book, yeah. Tenniel, who we talked about this month, was a Punch, you know, artist, I think. They convinced him to do the illustrations for it, which are iconic.
Yeah, he's great.
I do think he was getting a little tired of Carroll because he was sending things back a lot. That's not quite right. That's not quite right. And I'm sure you as an artist have experienced this.
Sure, yeah.
Where, you know, he got a little tired of doing it. But the marriage of those two, I mean, he's just as responsible for the success of the book, I think, as Carroll.
You just got to make sure you're getting paid by the hour and not by the job.
There you go.
Hard lesson to learn. So Disney was going to do a short animated Alice in Wonderland. Disney the man, not the company yet.
Yeah.
Back in 1923, and it was going to have a live-action Alice, and he was working with this place called Laugh-O-Gram Studio. But due to the budget and the studio failing, it was never released. And it said released, so I guess that exists somewhere, this 1923 Disney Alice of Wonderland thing. Now, in 1933, Disney tried to make a live-action movie with my distant cousin, Mary Pickford, but it was scrapped in favor of Snow White. There was also a 1933 live-action adaptation, so he wanted to stay away from that 33 movie, the one that you liked.
Yeah, that one I was enjoying. Well, they're all disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, the 1933 one, they just have these giant masks.
Right, like
there's
mascot
the whole
heads.
Scene with the baby and stuff. That's a real disturbing one in that.
Turns into the pig.
Tweedledee and Tweedledum look real, real creepy.
Yeah.
I was disappointed watching the 51 because, you know, the Cheshire Cat is saying lines from Jabberwocky, but out of context and not knowing what it is, it just comes off as nonsense.
Right.
And I mean, not in the good way.
No,
that's
no.
A funny thing to say.
Yeah.
But the totality of the poem is never presented in that movie.
Yeah.
There is no Vorpal sword.
Oh, no,
that's
no.
Disappointing.
Especially for all the D&D nerds out there.
The Walrus and the Carpenter is.
It's in there.
And quite early.
Yeah, and there's a lot, too. I mean, they spend a lot of time on it. There's a couple, I think there's two songs in the whole sequence about the Walrus and the Carpenter. And then they kind of switch it up in the end where the Carpenter is going to get seasoning and butter and bread to eat the oysters with. And when he comes back, the Walrus has eaten all of the oysters already.
Yeah.
He gets mad at him and chases him around and this little like whoop 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 kind of.
It's a double twist because there's the victimization of the oysters and they're so cute.
Yeah, they are.
They're like in their little babies and their little hoods. So he devours them and then he also kept them from the carpenter who's very upset about it. So they thought, we need to add an extra layer of menace to this. But I was very surprised that got adapted.
Yeah.
And it comes in, like I say, right away. She meets Tweedledee and Tweedledum. They're like, let's horrify this kid, telling her the story.
Well, I see. I thought it was kind of downplaying the horror of it by making it out to be the moral of the lesson is don't trust the walrus because he'll eat the oysters from you, even though the carpenter was going to be eating these oysters as well.
Oh, yeah. The walrus was saying we got to be duplicitous about this. The carpenter was just sort of on the surface about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was odd. It was a really odd thing. And I could see watching that as a kid and being a little freaked out by it. But by the fact that was in there made me think that later, especially when the Cheshire Cat kept saying the first stanza of Jabberwocky, I thought at some point he's going to tell this and then we're going to cut to the woods and we're going to go through that whole poem and have some interesting illustrated version of it. And that just didn't manifest. So a little of it was battling my expectations of what I was going to see.
Right. And they also don't have the Mock Turtle stuff in there either.
No.
That didn't make the cut. In 1938, Disney got the rights for Alice in Wonderland. He got a storyboard artist, Al Perkins, and art director David S. Hall to do some preliminary work on it. They did an animatic, but Disney didn't like it because it was too close to the Tenniel drawings. And it just dark. He just thought it was kind of creepy and he wanted it to be more fun and frivolous, I guess.
Yeah.
After the war in 1945, Disney started up again on production of this and he hired Aldous Huxley to write the script.
That's a little odd. Well, actually, it's not. He was a science fiction writer and...
Sure.
And an advocate for hallucinogenics, so... Makes sense.
This is from Wikipedia here. It says, Huxley devised a story in which Lewis Carroll and Alice Little, the inspiration for Alice, were misunderstood and persecuted following the book's publication. In Huxley's story, stage actress Ellen Terry was sympathetic to both Carroll and Little, and Queen Victoria served as a deus ex machina, validating Carroll due to her appreciation for the book. Disney considered child actress Margaret O'Brien for the role. However, he felt that Huxley's version was too literal an adaptation of Carroll's book.
How dare you do the source material as it was written?
So around that time, Disney was thinking of making the Alice movie with a live-action Alice, and he was thinking of Ginger Rogers as playing Alice, which again is, you know, she's a woman at this time. Yeah. She's not young. So that's, again, kind of strange. But then again, thought that that doesn't do the book justice, so having a live-action person in there. So he felt it should be all animated and went with that. The script was rewritten so many times that it is credited with 13 different writers.
Yeah, that blew my mind. So as I'm watching it, I paused on that credit screen and went, 1, 2, 3. What? There's 13 dudes who wrote this. How is that possible? I thought, did they pair off with an animator for each sequence, or is this just the chain of custody of this project?
Know. I'm not sure
how it
worked.
There's a lot of people.
Well, it seemed like Disney was tooling around with it for 20 years or so. So, you know, maybe he was kept going through different iterations and gave everybody who worked on those iterations credit.
Now, I'm curious what this means that Huxley's story had Lewis Carroll and Alice Little being misunderstood and persecuted following the book's publication.
Yeah. I want to know more about that. I don't know.
Because definitely, okay, so I won't go too, well, this is just of interest because the rumor is that Lewis Carroll might have been a repressed pedophile.
Yeah.
And I think that my takeaway is that it is a little like, say, H.P. Lovecraft, where his racism directly plays into his ability to write horrifying xenophobic things.
Yeah.
That the thing that makes him defective is actually what ends up making him maybe a little more powerful or raw as a writer. You don't need that stuff. You can be totally well-adjusted and still be fantastic.
Yeah.
But looking back, I think that sort of obsessive quality is what lends something to the fiction. And so if Virginia Woolf's saying that he has this access to children, nobody can argue that he wasn't obsessed with children. Through his whole life, past the Little family, he continued to befriend children, tons of these kids. Now, one thing that I found out is that his very first biographer wanted to take some of the lascivious nature away from that by aging the girls down. He was friends with a lot of teenage girls, and that biographer said, let's make them a little younger so that nobody thinks anything weird.
Oh.
And that speaks volumes as to how much the world's changed.
Yeah.
At that time, people just didn't go, oh, that guy's a pedo. You know, it just wasn't something that people would think. And so that did a little damage to his reputation, that tiny bit of change from his biographer.
Yeah.
That said, the other thing that Lewis Carroll was really into was photography.
Yeah.
And he took a lot of pictures of kids, a lot of pictures of naked kids, pictures that were nudes of these three girls in the Little family. That was the dean of Christ Church. That was his family. Some of them look a little provocative. A documentary I was watching about this, where near the end they go, ooh, we located another one of the oldest sister that we believe Lewis Carroll took in this museum in Paris. And they went and they looked at it. Now, at the time, taking a naked picture of a kid. Now, art is often depictions of the human form and the naked body. And children are regarded as widely innocent in a culture that does not sexualize them.
Yeah.
So these are things that are seen as what could be a more perfect, more innocent expression of the human form than a child is naked. And I get that. Also, when people had their photos taken, they didn't necessarily sit for a portrait the way that we do now. They might wear a costume or something dramatic. So the one picture of Alice that they show a lot, she's wearing this sort of beggar girl costume that's ripped and torn. That might not have been seen as strange. It's, to me, it looks like she's kind of, the look on her face is a little odd.
It seems inappropriate.
It seems inappropriate to me, but again, I'm not Victorian era. However, the one photo that they did locate of the older sister is just a full frontal nude and she's a teenager.
Yeah.
And it's pretty damning because it would not have been appropriate at that time either.
Yeah.
And we know that the Little family had a falling out with Dodgson, Lewis Carroll. The specifics of that are hard to get at because he, as this sort of OCD guy, kept a very meticulous journal of everything that was happening. That's why we know about this boat ride on the Thames, et cetera.
Yeah.
Those pages of his journal
were cut out of, noticeably cut out of his diaries by family members later, and they can't be found. Whatever did go on to cause that falling out, there are theories about it.
Sure.
But we can never know the details. Obviously, they were scandalous enough to cause them to want to dispose of the evidence.
Sure.
All of that leads me to believe that perhaps he was over-affectionate. Now, like I say, he had taken vows of celibacy. I think that perhaps it was just obsessive attraction. Maybe went a little too far. I don't think it was a Michael Jackson kind of situation where he was grooming families and bringing kids onto the property and doing all of these kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you can say there's gradations to this. It's one of those things we just can't know.
We can't know. And you're right. And it's the past and it's the distant past. There's enough of a gray area that I feel like I just want to not come down on anything and just believe what is more palatable.
Absolutely. Hey, that's what you always have to do when you're trying to separate artists from the art. And we truck in that all the time.
Oh my God.
I guess in this one, I was a little like mentioning Michael Jackson. Dude, I love that guy's music. And so how many years was I going, well, the evidence is staring at me in the face, but Thriller's a really good album, you know? And it was like until I watched that recent HBO documentary or whatever that I went, oh gosh, now I can't. I'm having a hard time even listening to this music. It penetrated, you know?
Well, I mean, like in Cosby, like we grew up, you know, Cosby, you know, stand-up thing. I watched over and over again when I was a kid. And, you know, the Cosby Show was Thursday night. My whole family, we would watch Cosby Show. We loved it, you know, on that lineup.
Yeah. I wanted to be in that family.
Yes, they were rad. It was a rad show, and it's probably still a rad show. It's just now that you know that that guy was drugging people and raping them, that it's, man.
Well, look, there are people who are scholars of Lewis Carroll who straight up say, yeah, there was something going on there. And then there's other, you know, I was watching a guy. He's like, I've been studying this guy and everybody around him and everything that's been written about him for 40 years. There's no suggestion that he did anything inappropriate.
Yeah.
And so while I think that he probably had some level of obsession with childhood that you would find in somebody who, say, their sexuality was arrested at a certain point, grew up with a lot of children, had his own things going on with that. You know, I mean, he grew up with a lot of sisters and so probably formed really tight relationships with them. And then later, being somebody who doesn't have his own children, continued to pursue sort of a fatherly, you know, interest in that sort of thing. And he did write Alice. I mean, he was a children's literature master.
Sure, yeah.
So he always had, he was a puzzle maker. He always had his pockets full of toys and puzzles and these kinds of things. So would you say a teacher is hanging out with too many children? No, because they're a teacher and you expect them to. So it's very similar to that. So you're right. I mean, it's a gray area. And so you don't have to get, the book's good no matter what. I mean, I would say actually, if there was one thing I took away from watching that 50s one, my biggest disappointment was the character of Alice. I'm sure there's lots of people who love that movie, but because you aren't privy to what she's thinking, you're not privy to her interior monologues and what's going on with this, this heroine, you're not really getting the full enjoyment of the book. I mean, it's a really groundbreaking work to have a child that smart as the protagonist. Therefore, I think the best expression of the book is the book itself. And I'll say that about a lot of things. You know, in fact, right now we're watching The Sandman and talking about that. Mm-hmm. It's a little tough for me to swallow because even though it's an entertaining show, I actually feel like that art was attained in the graphic novel, that's the most perfect form and expression of that story.
I understand.
So it's when people are asking me about it, I kind of want to say, will you just go read it first? Or or hopefully watching the show gets you to go read it because I feel like the art's already been completed. And similarly, and again, I'm not through the whole book, but I think that Alice's Adventures in Wonderland is meant to be read.
Sure. Yeah. I watched all the Sandman. I loved it. And I'm a big Sandman fan. I listened to the audio drama that they did. Audible did. Mm. They did, I think the first two graphic novels. I'm a fan. And I think it's amazing. I think it's really, really good. You're right. I don't think it's quite as good as, there's something about it being a graphic novel that doesn't quite translate.
Well, I could linger on the images and linger on the concepts and the thoughts and the splash pages and in ways that you can't when it's running past you a little too fast.
You're right.
There are aspects of Alice in that graphic novel series.
Mm-hmm.
There are aspects of Alice in the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath.
Yep.
Everybody talks on a daily basis. I hear somebody talk about going down the rabbit hole.
Sure.
He's not the first to write a story where a character goes on a journey, but I think it set the prototype for a character going on a totally batshit journey. You know, I think a lot of science fiction is indebted to this. The idea of going into a realm, journeying to the center of the earth or something along these lines where just none of the rules matter anymore.
Yeah.
And it's a totally alien civilization that you're not even, it's a work of weird fiction in that nothing's really explained to you.
Yeah.
The civilization is totally crazy down there because it's invented by a child who's possibly asleep on the riverbank, or she's privy to a world that she's ejected, because it does have that conclusion at the end of returning to the normal world, and that home is, you go through the experience so that you can come back home a changed person. And I think that that's present in the book as well, right?
Perhaps. I haven't read the book, so how different? I don't know how the book is different from the movie, the 1951 movie, at the end of it.
Well, in the movie, she sort of just has had enough. There is a screenplay structure to it. It's a series of episodes, but then she definitely hits the point where she's like, I'm alone, I hate this. You know, she has, before the croquet match and all that stuff, I want to get out of here. And then that totally insane croquet match happens. She says, you're just a pack of cards. You know, none of you are real. And that's what sends her home.
Well, yeah. And the Queen of Hearts chases her, and she's running. And as she runs through all the places that she's been. She runs into the characters that she's met. And then finally, she gets to that first door where she was trying to get the key. And the door says, oh, no, you're already outside. You don't need to open up the door. And she looks and sees herself sleeping.
Yeah.
And then she just kind of wills herself awake. And then that's the end of it.
She stops being pushed around by the stand-ins for the adults and takes some agency of her own, which I guess could be the takeaway. But her going back up through, by the way, all of the different places she's been, you know, what really reminded me of was Mad God, which is another child of Alice in Wonderland.
Sure.
The character descends down into this underworld through all these levels, and then on the way back up has to pass them all again. And similar to Mad God, I thought, because I was falling asleep a lot during this movie, I thought maybe I should have watched this episodically, because it's a lot of nonsense to take all in one sitting.
Yeah.
In the book, you know, you read about a chapter at a time and you put it down, so it naturally lends itself to that type of experience, which is another reason that maybe an adaptation isn't the best format for it.
Well, this adaptation at the time, like you said, wasn't too popular. One of the things about the movie, and maybe this is in the book as well, is that there's a lot of growth and shrinking in it.
A lot.
I thought it was just in the very beginning of the story where she's trying to get through the little door, she drinks it and the key's up on the table, and then she has to eat the thing that gets bigger. I thought that was it, but throughout the whole story, she's growing and shrinking, which is weird. It almost feels like it's a metaphor for something. I don't know what.
Oh, definitely. I mean, she's got, there's the eat me and drink me stuff that does it, and then she's got a magic fan that does it as well.
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt like, are there class things going on that I don't understand here? When the White Rabbit thinks that she's his servant and sends her to get his white gloves out of the house, and then she grows too big for the house, and they don't know how to deal with it, and they send Bill the Lizard in there, who is definitely a working class lizard. You go down the chimney and figure out what's going on. Now, there's obviously a giant person in the house. Why do they keep sending people in? And she, you know, blows him out of the chimney. And then I think they decide to burn the house down.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of reminded me of the remake of Fright Night, which I watched recently, because that's what Jerry does. They won't invite him into the house, so he just burns it all down. He's like, I don't have to be invited in if I destroy it. That's a great remake, by the way.
Yeah.
It revisited well. Not quite an Alice in Wonderland thing, though.
This whole idea, the idea of the absurdity and the growth and the shrinking, again, made me feel like, we talked about this before, where you try to make meaning in the nonsense. And I don't know how much of it is me trying to find something there or look for patterns where patterns don't really exist.
Yeah.
There's an element of that to it for sure.
Well, as you get older, you want to form more patterns. And that's kind of part of what the story is, too, is the adult brain versus the child brain.
Yeah.
My biggest takeaway from Alice, if there's meaning hidden behind it, is that the world is both wondrous and incredibly terrifying for a child.
Yeah.
You know, when Gayn Wilson is talking about how he never saw Alice as a kind-hearted, you know, children's adventure and more as a horror story, well, he's right.
Yeah.
So, folks, if you are a fan of just little half-tidbits of information that aren't backed up by any real scholarship, I hope we've tickled you in that regard.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm halfway through the book and have watched some things about this, but it's kind of interesting when it's something that is culturally so prevalent that you get to this age without really knowing much about, and it's been really rewarding to investigate this.
It has been. And it's the cultural influence. You can see it. Like you were saying, pretty much every 10 years, somebody makes an Alice in Wonderland movie.
Yeah.
And most celebrities have been in some kind of adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. It's important to talk about it. I didn't feel right just doing it as a regular story on our show because it is so nonsensical.
It wouldn't have made a good 4 weeks, no.
No, it would definitely not have made a good 4 weeks because it would just be us telling you some random weird stuff and trying to understand it or put our meanings on it. And I don't think that's what people want to hear. So you had to hear a little bit of it right now with this, but I think that this is probably the best forum for you and I to discuss this story.
Well, because it's nonsense, it's a little unstructured, a little nonsensical, unstructured conversation is probably the best way to attack it. So I'm glad we could do this. And I really loved how it played into these science fiction stories this month. And I guarantee that we're going to be seeing it maybe where we might have missed it before going forward. So it truly is a strange story and it influenced so many other strange stories. And so I'm glad we've been able to discuss it. Next month, we're starting out with some Tolkien.
Yes.
Who had to have been influenced by this book as well. So it's going to be interesting to jump into that next. And I hope you'll stick with us. This has been our extra credit episode for August. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and we're at strangestudies.com.
And this episode's been exclusive to Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.